Welcome to Witnessing Christ. Witnessing Christ is a truth and love ministry podcast designed to help biblical Christians witness to their Mormon friends, family, and missionaries. For more Bible-based resources, check out TILM.org. We have all kinds of resources to support you, including classes, witnessing scenarios, books, and so much more. Visit TILM.org today. Welcome back to another edition of the Witnessing Christ podcast. Today, I am joined by our four evangelist interns, Noah, Aaron, Caleb, and Ethan. Today, they had the assignment to read the book, Keep Showing Up, A Utah Pastor's Journey by Pastor Scott McKinney. Scott McKinney served as a Christian pastor in Orem, Utah at Center Point Church from about 1989 until 2023. So over 30 years of serving at Center Point. And the young men read this book this week, and we're just going to take a walk through it and really focus in on what they learned that's going to be very practical for them over the next year of their internship at Truth and Love, but also as they prepare for pastoral ministry in general. So, Noah, would you kick us off on just tell us a little bit about Scott McKinney and his early years and what brought him into LDS ministry?
Yeah, I'd love to. So it was kind of always just something that always interested him. He, in chapter one, tells us about how he had a girlfriend when he was young who was a Mormon, and he tried to talk to her about it, and he showed her the facts behind the truth of the Bible and behind the Book of Mormon and different things. And so in the end, he asks, "Well, so what are you going to do?" And her answer is, "I'm not going to do anything. What you don't realize is that this is my family. These are my people. This is who I am." And this is a big theme that pops up throughout his book. This is a whole worldview for them. This is their lives. This is what they know. And a lot of them, they know that there are holes in it, and they feel those every day. But why would they leave if there's nothing to fill it in? If they don't understand the gospel and what Christ has done for them. And so that brings to another theme that he continually brings out in this book, is just keeping the gospel at the center. And it's what I think really excited him about doing a ministry in Utah in the future.
Yeah. And one thing I was just super glad about was that he was very open with his insecurities, and even not knowing what the main thing was yet. I mean, even at the end of the first chapter, he's like, "I have no clue where I'm going now. Disappointment to my father, you know, didn't finish the Naval Academy, didn't continue playing football." And so in many ways, I appreciate how he starts the story saying, "Hey, I don't know where I'm going yet." But then that brings me into the book to kind of get me to ask the question, all right, where does he go next? How does this work?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I really appreciated about him sharing his story about how he got into this was that history with his family and football, where there were all of these expectations of this is who you needed to be, and you need to go to this school, you need to follow in the lineage of your father who played for one of the military schools and served. And so he's able to connect right away to the LDS story of just the expectations of a culture and not living up to that. And I think it's one of the many ways that God really prepared him for doing ministry in the LDS world. Is there anything else in his kind of college years that you thought was interesting as far as how God was preparing him to participate in full-time pastoral ministry? I love the title of those first couple chapters. He's the all-American family. He's brought up in this football family. And then the second one is anything but a pastor. So it's like there's lots of other things out there, but not this one. Where did he start, Aaron? Do you remember as far as his actual career, and how did he end up becoming a pastor?
Yeah, I think he ended up becoming a pastor because he well he went to seminary, and then he ended up graduating and then really wasn't a pastor for a while. Then he went to he found a job. I think he was teaching, right? He was teaching in a at a place in where was that? Was that in California, I think. And then he ended up becoming he was a football coach. He ended up becoming the pastor there because oh man. I think he also he just had one of those experiences where he was out for a walk. This just says he was going for a walk, praying about the future, and the words came to his mind, you're a pastor. And that was his moment for him, was realizing that that's what he wanted to do. Something that he kind of talked about, speaking of being open, is how much that he was kind of like a sarcastic and cynical guy. And he realized that is something that you cannot be, especially with the way that he talked in church. He said, you need to not do that, I guess. and kind of realized one of the things he says is he was called to love the sheep and care for them. And you can't do that and be cynical and sarcastic about them. And so I kind of liked how open he was about that, about how it takes a while for him to kind of realize his true goal or his true calling, I guess.
Yeah, and I really appreciated that too, how he was kind of relaying this story of how he went from being this cynical, humorous guy in his own words. And he said that the thought of being a pastor didn't occur to him because he thought pastors were just uptight, stuffy, like holier than thou kind of people. And then, yeah, like you said, Aaron, he once he becomes a pastor, once he sees what it's all about, it's not about being uptight or stuffy or proving to everyone else how good of a Christian you are when you're a pastor, but it's the love. It's caring for the people that God has given you. And I mean, throughout his book, throughout his story and hearing about his ministry, he never comes off as uptight or stuffy. And if anything, he just puts his full pastoral heart on full display for the people in his church and the people in his community, which is a beautiful thing to see.
Absolutely. So he starts off his pastoral ministry at a church in California. Caleb, do you remember, like, how does he end up finally making it to Utah? So it had been laid on his heart years ago with that relationship with the girlfriend that those people need to be reached. But how did he actually end up getting there? That's kind of an interesting part of his story.
Yeah, well, he ends up making a connection within the church. He's an associate pastor of a guy who goes and visits this church out in Utah. And just one of these times he goes with. and something about it called him to the situation, is what he says. And eventually he tells this guy, hey, if there's ever an opening out there, can you just like throw my name in there? And I think he said it was that very trip that the guy went and the pastor resigned at the service. And he's like, don't worry, guys, I got the next one. And so then he tells a story about going and visiting and the hopelessness of the situation and saying, ain't no way I'm going. But then eventually changing his mind despite all logic and despite perhaps even the advice of the people around him.
Yeah, and the next chapter he titles it as "You Have No Idea," really saying like I'm getting myself into something that I am not ready for, and this area is just so different than anywhere else, perhaps in the world, when it comes to doing ministry. What were some of the things that this church that he was working with needed to undergo some pretty serious introspection, self-reflection before they were going to be ready to be relevant in the in that area?
He talks a lot about what shows up a couple of times in the book, what he calls the fortress mentality. And when he first got to this church, he notices that these people have just built up so many walls. The LDS church, especially in that area, is just incredibly powerful. And if you're gonna compare churches, the LDS church is gonna win it every time. They have more money, they have more prestige, more opportunities to be with people, to make connections. And so it almost seemed to make this church kind of shrivel in on of itself in a sense where they just think, okay, we have the gospel and we're gonna stand on the gospel, but in this place, it just it doesn't grow. We just don't grow. And yet they still are living in a place that's surrounded with people, people that so desperately need to hear the gospel. And this is what fires up Pastor McKinney, is that he has the opportunity to make this culture shift from a fortress mentality to an outreach mentality, where now, okay, because of the gospel, we get to go outside of these walls and tell what Jesus has done as our substitute to the world, including all the people who need to hear it, the people that are in the doors right next to our church building. So it was really cool to see him just try to make that culture shift and be super dedicated to
it. Yeah, I thought the sentence that really struck home to me was the old church needed to die and there needed to be a resurrection. Like, wow, that sounds like fighting words right there.
His example that he uses, like biblical example, and he's like, man, this is just like the spies going into Canaan. And when he talks about the Nephilim, like these, you know, the big giants, that's how they felt, you know. And just he said that's a pretty apt description of the way we saw ourselves in contrast with the LDS culture is that. But, you know, taking away from that story is like what Caleb said, that's what happened to that generation who said that they couldn't invade Canaan, is they all died in the wilderness. Yeah. And so it's cool to see she took inspiration from the Bible, and it's definitely a close situation to what he was in at that time.
When you said Caleb, I really thought you're referencing something I said for a moment, but
no, the Caleb, your namesake. Yeah. So at this time when Pastor McKinney and his wife and family arrived in Utah County, it was actually growing in the number of LDS people. So he mentions early on that at this time in the late 1980s already, Salt Lake City itself had really shrunk as far as its Mormon population. And some of those folks had kind of moved out of the city into Utah County, which at this point was over 600,000 people. And where he was at there in Orem was right next to BYU University and Utah Valley University in Provo. And those schools alone had 70,000 students, with the vast majority of them being LDS. And then there were temples and there were LDS meeting houses everywhere he went. And so this made that whole, we are little grasshoppers in this land of giants idea just very striking. So how does he deal with that idea that we're so small compared to this large thing? And he's even have people that are telling, like, it's never going to happen here. That's the title of the next chapter. Like, this is just not a place where a church is going to be able to survive, let alone thrive in this community. Talk to me a little bit about how those first few years were difficult, but what was God teaching them during that time?
So looking through it, he almost had to like prove himself to his neighbors. I mean, he was moving into this vast majority Mormon community, and he said his neighbors would, you know, kind of welcome him and be all friendly and see him as someone for them to win. And then when they realized that they couldn't win him and get him to join their church, he said it almost felt like they were disappointed. They were kind of leaving him alone. He had to show that he was there to love them, to care for them. And so he talked about that he was, you know, encouraging his church in, right, to get out of the fortress mentality. Don't just hunker down and survive, but get out and reach out. It's not about reaching out and attacking or fighting or knocking down the Mormons and Mormonism, but it's about fighting for them. It's about showing them Jesus' love, and in so doing, showing them how much you love them.
Yeah. In this environment that he found himself, the love that he needed to personify both to those on the outside of his church and on the inside of the church really resonated with me, because as someone who's very much focused on reaching the lost and outreach, sometimes in pastoral ministry, the people that you actually need to love the most are the ones that are already a part of your congregation first, because they may not have the same outreach mindset that you have. and maybe focused more on that fortress mentality. And so one of the things that he really talked about is that his wife, Sarah, was the one that really taught him, we have to love the people that God has already given us to. And really some of the older members specifically he talked about were not ready to be this welcoming oasis in this land of giants. And so how difficult that was. And so just lots of love in different ways. React to this quote. It's on page 48, the end of that chapter, where he said, kind of talking about the big question that he needed to answer during this time was, do we value the people that we're serving because they will help us reach our goals of growing a church? Or do we value people because God loves them? That's a question that many a church planter has had to wrestle with. In our denomination, when a pastor is sent to start a new mission congregation, one of the things that they have to keep track of every month is their numbers. And those numbers are indicative of success from at least a worldly, earthly perspective, faithfulness from a worldly, earthly perspective, and it will also determine whether or not they continue to receive financial backing from our national church body. And so as someone who has been in that environment, it's hard because every single prospect you look at in two different ways as, wow, this person is a lost child of God that needs Jesus, but I also need them to help my congregation grow. Is that something you guys have thought about much yet? Have you had any classes on how to deal with that? Caleb, you maybe had a thought.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was having this discussion the other day with people. It's how do you measure faithfulness? And one way people do it, right, is from the fruits of the faithfulness, you know, the number of people, the amount of sustaining income. But I thought that Scott McKinney did a great job of focusing on the numbers are going to be the numbers. The important part is that we love them, that we proclaim the gospel to them, and that especially like in the role of a pastor shepherding the flock that God gave him.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Another thing to kind of branch off that is that I had a professor in college who would often say, it's so easy when we're witnessing, and even when we're just talking to people, to not view them as a person. In the Scott McKinney's case, in terms of a number where he's like, I'm starting this church or I'm rebooting this church and I need to see it grow. Or even when you're just talking to the clerk at the grocery store who's like checking you out, it's so easy not to view them as a person. Based on the gospel, based on what we have, you know, people aren't just these things walking around. People are children of God whom he sent his son to love and to die for. And so in the book, we see Pastor McKinney like pulled in two directions where he's like, I'm trying to do my best in service to God as we grow the church, but also make sure that we care for each individual person.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I do like that question because it kind of underlines how we can truly show the difference being the grasshoppers and the giants. What's the difference? Obviously the size, that's not a great example, but especially when evangelizing, showing the difference between the two religions, because they are some key differences. And so recently I've been talking to some Mormon missionaries and they would just drop stuff on like, oh, we've had this many baptisms in this month. Granted that they're a missionary and that's kind of their purpose, but they kept talking about that. Like the answer to the first question, it seems like they were valuing them because they helped reach their goals of growing a church. And we can show how much more different we are because we value people because God loves them. And, you know, that's truly something that you can use to kind of show you're dedicated to each and every individual person, if that makes any sense.
It really does, Aaron. And I think that's one thing as we contrast ourselves with what the LDS church is doing, we have to avoid turning people into a project in the same way that they do and really see them in the light of the gospel. As it often does in pastoral ministry, it's not just the professional aspects of life that are hard. Sometimes the personal parts of life get very difficult. There's an entire chapter where it's just family life gets hard. Scott's wife, Sarah, has cancer, and it's a very tough season of life for them, but it also helps them grow as a family. And during this time, the congregation has to go through a lot too. That really works into what he refers to as kind of chapter two of the church in Orem. Somebody take a stab at kind of walking us through what did chapter two look like in this whole church planting, replanting, chapter two, and into building a home.
Yeah. So after, you know, God had blessed their efforts and let the church grow, it got to a point where their current building just was not enough for them. They reached a point where they had to relocate. Part of that was size, and also part of that was just where their building was located. It sounded like it was right across the street from the high school, which I would think would be pretty visible if a lot of people are coming to the high school, but apparently it was easy to overlook.
Must have been hidden somehow.
Yeah. Apparently, maybe behind the LDS seminary or something. So they started this whole chapter two kind of project or campaign where they, as a church, really recommitted to their mission, which was to serve the people in the community where they were at. And for that, they saved up money. They ended up buying a big plot of land on the highway outside of town that he said was impossible to miss. Like you said earlier, they were just miles from BYU and from all the other the colleges and the traffic down there. But even in this chapter too, he talks about all the struggles that they were going through, all the different building hiccups, I guess, and the time it took to buy the plot of land. He said as soon as they bought the land, the recession of 08 hit and they were kind of stalemated for a while. And then all the different solutions they tried to find of temporary places or temporary structures out on the land just did not work. And so he said it was very easy to get discouraged. It was very easy to kind of hang their head and think, well, what are we doing? Why did we ever try to change, or why are we even doing this? But at the same time, I loved how at the end of that chapter, he highlighted that this was one of the times that God was giving them their biggest blessings, where God was using them to reach more and more people, where he's going to say a quote from him. I see on page 56, he said, during those years, hundreds of people came to Christ and were baptized. We were seeing entire families from LDS backgrounds come to faith. We were ministering to children and youth in an effective way. And just even in all the struggles and the troubles and the kind of growing pains of this chapter two for Centerpoint Church, just the great grace that God had in blessing their mission, blessing their ministry, and bringing more and more people to Christ through them.
Thanks for that summary. One of the ideas that really starts to build in this chapter into the next one on building a home is the idea that once you've developed as a local congregation, this is who we are, this is what we're going to be about, this is how we're going to keep the main thing the main thing. When bumps in the road occur, there is a great temptation to say, ah, we got to start doing things differently. We got to go in a new direction. And it's actually his son and son-in-law that help him with this. Do you remember that story about how the two coaches helped him kind of redirect in ministry? Caleb, do you remember that part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, they got destroyed on opening day, I think, the coaches. And so he went up to them. He's like, hey, what are you going to do differently? And their response was, we're not going to do anything differently. We're doing the right things. We just need to keep doing them and then we'll be fine. And maybe that gets back to the idea of being faithful. That's pretty much what he did. They kept going. I thought it was interesting as he continued the leading the people of God into the wilderness analogy. He was wondering, he had the insecurity. He was like, had I led the church out into the wilderness to die? And in the end, God provided. And it was cool to see how their journey to get a new church home became a reality.
Yeah. You just see so many of those biblical themes throughout this story. And then as we're going to get to at the end, he uses the story of the woman at the well as another powerful metaphor. So it'll be great when we get there. The next few chapters, he really starts outlining for us what it was like to be in a location where the LDS church again, is so much bigger, to the sense where it almost seems like Christianity is the junior varsity team and Mormonism is the varsity, and that there really isn't a competition between the two, in a sense. So somebody talk to me about these next few chapters. What is he learning about how to do outreach in LDS ministry? What are some things to do, and what are some things not to do? I highlighted a number of little nuggets in here. Hopefully you guys did too.
Yeah, for sure. One of the big things is not conforming to their view of us. So as, you know, Mormons see themselves as varsity Christians, they see us as junior varsity Christians, how they have this superior Christianity because of the revelation that they have been given. And it's a good thing to keep in mind for all Christians, no matter who you're witnessing to, is you're not in the majority. And to expect that you're going to be quote unquote normal in this world is just not how it goes. And it's not what Christ has promised us. He has promised us a cross. He has not promised us a crown. He has not promised us heaven here on this earth. He never says, oh, you're going to be in the majority and it's going to be normal, and people from all across are just going to flock to you all at once. And he talks a lot more about it as a remnant, people who he preserves, whom he has chosen, whom he loves, and not that it's ever going to be great in this world, but we don't have our confidence in this world. Our confidence is in heaven, what Christ has prepared for us. And so this is Pastor McKinney's confidence too. He says, you can't live here and define yourself by what your LDS neighbors think of you. You have to define yourself by what God thinks of you. Our job as a church is to help people define themselves by what they are rather than what they are not. So one big thing is just, you know, we are redeemed. We are redeemed children of God who get to go and share the gospel with all people. This is our identity. And it's not determined by other people in this world. It's determined by Christ, who gives us that identity.
I really liked, he talked about in and out. It talked about like the business model of in and out. And not that that's like a great business model for a church, because church really isn't a business, but he talked about how in and out was just trying to keep it simple, do one thing and do it the best you can. And it also says in and out understood that the competition was not out there. They were trying to keep it true to their own, true their values. And because of that, they really were able to succeed in business. And I guess in that same light, you could do that with the light of the gospel that we preach, you know, preach it the best that you can. So he kind of talked about how Mormonism was the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They were the church of more. And then he had a direct chapter called Less is More. And then he just talked about keeping it simple. Simple is powerful. He also talks about how sometimes he'll come back at it if anybody says, oh, we have more. And then he'll say things like, yes, but we have less. All that we have is Jesus, and he is enough. And that was really powerful to kind of see how much he said, we're just going to do one thing and we're going to do it well, you know, the best that we can.
Yeah, the first time I read this book a few years ago, it was that chapter, Less is More, that really stuck out to me. And his whole concept of Mormonism is aptly named because it is the gospel of more. What were some of the ways in which he described the more of the Mormon gospel or the Mormon church that is important for us to keep in mind? He says, we actually have less and that's better, but what are some of the more, and why are those more so appealing?
Well, he's got a nice long list for us listed out. You know, it says that Mormons would say, we have the fastest growing church in the world. That's one of them. They have strong families. They live healthy lifestyles where they do not smoke or drink. They tithe and go on 2-year missions at their own expenses. Our bishops serve without pay. Your pastors are paid. We have a prophet you don't. We have more scripture and more revelation. We have a special gift of the Holy Ghost and God's true priesthood power. And we are worthy to go into God's sacred temple. You can't. And that is what a lot of people are really attracted to is towards all of those topics right there.
Yeah, and isn't that a big part of human nature to always be looking for something outside of God's revealed word to us? We want something that we can add to the gospel that will give us a sense of control. And that's really what he's starting to connect with here, is that instead of focusing so much on all of these mores, he needs to focus on the one thing. Jesus is enough. Jesus is enough. A name of a great ministry that we know. We may have gotten some of those ideas from this chapter. This kind of gets us towards the end of the first section of the book. Was there anything looking back on this that you would say, I wanted to talk about that we didn't get a chance to yet? Anything in his and Centerpoint Church's initial story?
Well, just to that point of Jesus is enough, which is the beautiful, simple message of Scripture. You may think by adding more to Jesus, you're getting more. Like, yeah, you Christians have Jesus, but we LDS have Jesus and fill in the blank. But the more you add to Jesus, the smaller Jesus becomes. I mean, it reminds me of Galatians. The gospel plus anything equals nothing. If you add anything to grace, grace is no longer grace. But like you said, that's the very tempting and appealing thing of Mormonism, is that it promises more. It promises to give you more direction, more meaning, more purpose, more agency, more whatever. But the more of anything else you have, the less Jesus you have. And, well, Jesus is all you need.
All said. As we work into this next section, which is titled Understanding Mormon Culture, we're going to do things a little bit differently here. And I'm just going to ask each of the guys to kind of give me some major takeaways. And we can work through the chapters kind of as they come in order. But just go around. Let's start with Aaron this time and just kind of say, what were some of the things when it comes to what he helped us understand about Mormonism and our way of relating to Mormons and speaking the truth and love to Mormons that jumped out at you?
Yeah, something that I picked up on one of the chapters is persecuted people. And they really kind of use that because of the persecution and how this all religion came about. Many people thought that this was kind of fringe ideas from Joseph Smith. And because he was being persecuted, he used that to show the validity of what he was preaching. And I think that mentality is still around. You can't go out and start attacking them, because then they'll say, oh, look, we have another guy who's just going to try and persecute us. And that must mean that something is true about what Joseph Smith said. And that just kind of convolutes your sort of evangelism if you're going to try and reach out to them.
Really good thing to bring up. And that persecution complex, even though it is less persistent in the Latter-day Saint culture today, it's definitely still there. And so as we communicate, we try to speak in a way that is non-confrontational, where we're not putting up any unnecessary barriers right away that put up that persecution red flag. Other insights from these chapters?
Well, building off of what Aaron said, and then after what you said, Pastor Parsons, on how it's not necessarily that way anymore, they do enter into, he calls it, an era of accommodation, where because of the persecution that's being laid down upon them, which is very much actually having an effect on the lives of Mormons in those days, because of the teachings of polygamy, for example, and how they have completely changed directions in some ways, where formerly they were anti-family. And now I don't know if there's a group of people more for the family than the Mormon church today. And so, I mean, just seeing how they have changed through the years, starting with the persecutions and, well, the first chapter of the book was All American, and it kind of feels like, to some extent, the Mormon church, the people of the Mormon faith are very American.
Off that, it's really appealing to our culture, and they've almost leaned into this idea that you can come up with your own truth. And they do this with through certain teachings like direct revelations and different things like this. But something that really stuck out was how many things aren't helpful when you are trying to reach out to members of the LDS Church. For example, oftentimes bringing up Mormon history, it puts them onto the defensive, or bringing up the Book of Mormon and its historical validity, bringing up just the fact that so many Christians consider them to be a cult, bringing that up is also not helpful. Like we can point out all the inconsistencies we want, but what changes hearts is not necessarily these consistencies. It's the gospel. As Paul says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes.
Yeah, Noah, that last part you were talking about there is one of the biggest takeaways that I had the first time reading through this. Was even though this entire section is really designed to help the Christian lay witness or even a pastor that's reading this have a better understanding of Mormon doctrine, he is not providing this, and it's very clear in the way that he talks throughout these chapters. He's not providing this so that you will go out and just constantly be doing a comparing and a contrasting between Mormonism and biblical Christianity, because that inherently is going to lead to a debate. But instead, he's saying, like, some Mormons just need to see the real thing. I loved his illustration. I don't know if it was in this section or later on, of the dog with the bone. How Mormons are like a dog with a bone, that they're just going to cling onto this thing with every fiber of their being until you throw them a slab of real meat. And they're not going to leave the broken thing behind until the real thing is presented to them. Noah, at the end of the Were Christians 2 chapter that these guys were talking about, there's a really cool story that Scott tells about another pastor that talks about a conversation that he was having with a very devout LDS man. And this devout LDS man just kept saying, I agree with that. Or he was trying to make it sound like, yep, we agree with the exact same things. And then he said this: one day, this pastor asked Dan a question that rocked his world. He said, Dan, how come you are constantly trying to make what you believe sound like what I believe, when I feel absolutely no need to make what I believe sound like what you believe? What did you make of that? I thought that was a pretty intriguing way of asking a question.
Yeah. The first time I read it, obviously in my mind, it's like huge mic drop moment kind of deal. It's definitely asking someone else to look outside of their point of view and to say, I'm making what I believe sound like what you believe. But this pastor I'm talking to, he doesn't feel the need to do that. He doesn't have to make what he believes sound like what I believe, because he has this confidence in what he believes that comes from outside of himself. And then as Dan is thinking about this, he says, if Mormonism is true Christianity, then wouldn't it make sense that the rest of the Christian world would try to make what they believe sound like Mormonism? And so it really comes down to what the basis of your truth is. Is it what God reveals to us in the Bible? Is it personal scriptures that man has come up with? And maybe another point to add to this is, like, this isn't just like a snap your fingers type moment, like, oh yeah, suddenly Dan just like got it. He got this light bulb moment and then everything's good. Obviously this took time. It's a long time in coming to realize what the truth is, and it's not anything that they even realize. It's what the Spirit does and how he works in their heart, works faith and gives them faith through the gospel over time. And what a privilege it is that oftentimes we do get to see people realize what the Bible says is true. So,
yeah, you alluded to this, Noah, of even though this was a mic drop type of question or statement, he used this within the context of a relationship that he had been building. And so this would not be the kind of question that I would drop to the missionary sitting at my kitchen table during meeting with the very first time I'm meeting with them. 6 weeks in, 7 weeks in, as I know they're going to move on soon, I might use a question like that. Ethan, did you have anything else in this section two that you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, the part that you brought up stood out to me too, about just the Mormon church is just so apt, so eager to sound Christian. And I'll just keep reading from the section we were pulling from earlier, where Pastor McKinney says that he realized that he, this Mormon missionary, and other Mormons were doing everything they could to sound like the very people they believed to be part of the great apostasy, which is just very interesting to read the section to hear just kind of how the LDS culture and mindset works. It very much walks this fine line between, you know, wanting to identify as Christian and say we're Christian, but also if they're true to their teaching, well, then every other Christian church has to be false. If the LDS church is the one restored, you know, true gospel church, then every other church is, what is it, an abomination that Joseph Smith used in his vision? Which you kind of see that tension, which, I mean, makes sense. Pastor McKinney even labeled one of his chapters, you know, the living with that tension in their history. Just the LDS church just has such a unique mindset with its history, where they're so proud of where they come from, right? They have Joseph Smith and his revelation and the Book of Mormon and everything. But also, Pastor McKinney listed at least three examples throughout the history of the LDS church where their leaders have had to go back and change what was originally revealed as inspired and true doctrine, just because it was going against the culture of the time and it was creating a barrier. And so it's just this weird tension of holding on to the past, holding on to their heritage and history, while at the same time trying to distance themselves from the parts that separate them from the rest of American culture or from the Christian church. So that part just was really interesting to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
I maybe missed some of it, but I did catch you, Ethan, talking about that first vision and all the professors are corrupt of the other creeds and they're an abomination. I did bring that up to the missionary I've been seeing. And I said, you know, I'm really learning a lot about the Church of the Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and its history. And something I just can't get around is this first vision. Because if I'm understanding this correctly, this would thus make me an abomination. And he goes, no, you're not an abomination. And we've been starting to become like really friends and have a good relationship. And he said, no, you're absolutely not. You're not an abomination. I said, well, but I say those same things that those people were saying. And then he said, no, it was just like the people, you have to remember the context is important. You know, this is like what they were saying back then. And I said, I say those same, I kept pushing back hard on it. I'm like, I'm sorry. I say those. He's like, no, but I mean like the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed. And I said, yes, I know. I say those things every week in church. And I don't know if it's something to note here, but yeah, that's especially what he teaches about the church, that unfortunately there is some things that you cannot really reconcile with, especially, you know, however much they try and be polite, that's a stumbling block for me, and definitely for other people too as well.
Right. As we wrap up this section, we're going to take a break and come back on a future episode with the last part of the book. But guys, are there anything when it comes to the work that you're doing this year and preparation for pastoral ministry, just kind of in general, that you would say, you know what, I definitely want to keep this in mind. Something that really was a big takeaway that you want to share with our audience.
One thing that I'm definitely learning and trying to implement is just meeting people where they're at. I mean, you can do all the study on Mormonism. You can know their doctrine better than the church knows it, or better than the average Mormon knows it. But if you don't take the time to actually get to know the person in front of you and spend some time building a relationship, see just where they're coming from, you're never going to get through to them. You're never going to have an impact. You can't just barge into a situation assuming you know everything and you know exactly where it's going to go and you know exactly what they're going to say. But you just got to take the time to get to know them, to show them that you love them, and then to share Jesus with them.
Yeah, I think off that, one of the big key takeaways that I'd like to just implement, of course, now, but just for the rest of my life, is one of his main themes is just keeping the main thing the main thing. So often it's easy for us as sinners to like make things super complicated in our mind, but God's word it's not complicated. It's not this thing that we're trying to grasp, but it's almost impossible to know. No, in fact, it's the exact opposite. It's so simple that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And this is the heart of everything we do, and this is our very life as Christians, right? That Christ reconciled us to God by giving his life for us as a substitute, and we get to now go and share this because this is the center of our lives. It's not complicated, it's clear. And our sinful nature tries to make it so complicated, but just keeping the main thing that God reconciled us to himself through Christ, it's makes a world of difference. And it is the very reason we as Christians live.
I guess my takeaway has kind of been, so I'm one of the younger ones here. I just started studying to be a pastor. The other guys have been doing it for a few years at the seminary here. And one small thing that I've noticed is that it just makes me appreciate more what I'm learning in school. I think it's maybe a kind of shows how much this is a concrete thing and you kind of live it out every day and you're always constantly learning. And that includes how to talk to people of this big behemoth of a well-established church that believes some things that maybe we don't, that we don't believe.
Yeah. And hopefully, Aaron, that then just makes you all the more zealous to continue your studies, but also take what you're studying and bring it into this world of evangelism. Well, guys, I am so thankful to have walked through the first two-thirds of this book with you. Next time, we'll take a look at the last part, which is What Would Jesus Do?, where Pastor McKinney uses the extended illustration of Jesus and the Samaritan woman at the well as a witnessing guideline for us. And he does such a good job of it. So I can't wait to dig into that with you next time. So guys, thanks so much for being here today. We look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Witnessing Christ. Witnessing Christ is a Truth in Love ministry podcast. For more resources, visit tilm.org. If this podcast and other Truth in Love ministry resources have been a blessing to you, consider supporting the mission to proclaim Christ to Mormons and empower Christians to witness by visiting tilm.org/give.